at the end last time, I talked a little bit about the first public step against the Jews after the Nazis came to power, which was the boycott in April of 1933. And that was, in large part, the unleashing of the SA, the brown shirt street fighters of the Nazis, because they had been chomping at the bit to do this sort of thing. And it was messy. They would stand in front of Jewish businesses and to spray paint them and heckle, and there was some physical abuse as well. And this probably holds for the whole process. There were complaints or grumbling or even perhaps some open resistance to the mishandling of people who you knew. The store where you went to get your bread, or the store where you went to get your groceries. People weren't too happy about seeing those people pulled out into the street and forced to scrub it with a toothbrush and so on. So that only lasted for 24 hours. And the party learned from that to a certain degree. And as I was explaining at the end last time, this was may have been some indication that they were going to have to figure out something to do with this SA. This was the revolutionary arm of the party and had been very useful before the party was in power. But it was a liability once they were in power, and their job was to manage government efficiently and maintain order. The other thing to keep in mind is that they'd been kept at a heightened state all along this process of getting into power, and told that they were going to be recompensed for this. But they were in this this state of constant electioneering, this constant battle of constant movement, and wanted action. And that also wasn't forthcoming, wasn't going to happen immediately. So although in the long term we can see that the Third Reich has to maintain some sort of momentum, keep this movement flowing somehow by having at least demonstrations, rallies, and so forth. In the first 2 years, there are just tons of rallies. They continue with this constant electioneering process, probably just to give these people something to do in some way. And then that particular issue culminates with, we talked about it a little bit, the Night of the Long Knives, where the leaders of the SA, who were still complaining and wanted to have positions of power in government or take over the military, and they had all these guys, all this muscle behind them, they had to be taken care of. And so you have this internal purge of Nazis against Nazis, and the SS rising to a place of increasing significance as a result of that. And that happened just before the film The Triumph of the Will. I talked a little bit about that last time. But then it's not, this problem, this Jewish issue, this Jewish problem is secondary to gaining and maintaining control of German society, getting rid of political enemies, right? And something that has to be worked out. And this is this question of intentionalism versus functionalism. They don't immediately start carting Jews off. And if that was their principal and primary goal, and that was why they wanted to be in power, there aren't indications of that. It takes 33, I have to do some math here, which is kind of sad, 8 years for what we know of as the final solution to evolve. Okay, 8 years. It's not 8 months. The next step are a series of legal steps. First, some civil servant laws, which basically push Jews out of public positions, obviously any government positions, which they had immediate control of. Then in 1935, you have what are known as the Nuremberg Laws. And those were officially known as the laws to protect German blood. And these, here's where this racial anti-Semitism shows up legally, right? Because Jews were forbidden to marry Aryans from that point on. And also there are increasing efforts to identify what is Jewish, which is a problem. How many quarters do you have to have? How far back are you going to trace? It's during this period that genealogical studies, your family background and so on, just become central. And it's an obsession. There's no doubt about it. These genealogical logical centers. Obviously, we're working overtime to identify who had. And for the most part, now this could vary, and it varied a lot, and there were lots of debates and negotiations and individual cases that belie this, but basically a quarter, one grandparent. If it was a grandparent on your mother's side, then that would be even more damning, but that's what it comes down to, so one quarter would be enough. But there are all sorts of nuances that make the whole thing very complicated, and at the time made it complicated for those who were deciding whether they were going to stay or not. And this is another sub-issue of the story of the Holocaust. I don't think people say it critically, but there's sometimes a question, well, why? How could you stay around when all this was going on? And I don't think we'll take too much time to answer that because there's so many factors there. But one of the factors would be, well, I'm only quarter Jewish, or I'm married to an Aryan woman, and some of those were protected. It didn't hold in all cases, but it was possible. So the fuzziness of some of the policy was complicated things for people who were trying to make decisions. Now the other factors are, listen, you're born and raised in Germany, all your family is here, you are German except by this racial definition, anybody else would think so. It's not that easy to pull up and leave. And another factor is, of course, where are you going to go? How are you going to get your resources out? What are you going to do when you get there? And all that was made more difficult by the fact that there were quotas for the influx of Jews into most other Western nations, including the United States. So it was not that easy to get into the United States unless you had a sponsor and so on. And many of you may even have family backgrounds or you're even more aware of this. But it was not easy to get a place, to go somewhere. And as these laws are applied, there are increasing economic stipulations, so that if you were to leave, it really meant that you were leaving empty-handed. They weren't going to let you take any of your goods out, because that would basically be, a process of Jews taking German goods and German wealth out of the country, and that's how they defined it. And so you, if you were going to leave, you were choosing to go a very difficult path and with no security about your future. Another thing that was involved around the Nuremberg laws, which is significant, and I said they were doing the studies, but they were starting to compile lists at that time, and that was managed by SS, Gestapo, under Himmler's control. So that file keeping, that bureaucratic aspect of it, that's the first step, is identifying who they are. That begins with these laws about marriage. Now, between 37 and 38, there's all sorts of legislation from different ministries of the government in what Ian Kershaw, the biographer and supreme historian, I would say, of the period, calls this process of working toward the Führer. This is not really coming from top down. It's coming from the bottom up or the middle up. Bureaucrats, lawyers doing this work. Throwing up balloons and seeing if they work. Pressing to demonstrate that they understand the intentions of the Führer and are trying to work out policies that coordinate with that. And you get a series of things like exclusion from tax benefits, detail stuff, exclusion from all state financial aid, expulsion from professions like medical profession, legal profession. Jewish doctors are only able to service Jews. All Jews are disbarred. And then further Aryanization of the economy, in other words, seizures of businesses and so forth. For a really powerful sense of how this impacted individuals on the ground, I can't recommend strongly enough a two-volume memoir by a German person of Jewish background named Victor Klemperer. And it's called I Will Bear Witness. We can do so little in this class in the time. It's a lifetime commitment to confronting the horrors of war and the horrors of the Holocaust in particular. So, you know, I can just recommend that if you want to feel this on a day-to-day basis, that you read through these. It's beautifully written. Klemperer was a scholar. He was a professor of French literature outside in Dresden, I believe. And he kept this diary. After a certain period, he couldn't write professionally anymore, and you get the whole experience of him being drummed out of the university, his students disappearing first, and then ultimately being sacked. And just to fill his time, because he's a writer, you can just tell this is just a man who needs to write down what's going on a daily basis. He kept this voluminous memoir through the whole experience and on into the East Germany. He ended up living in East Germany as well, and his memoir, there are third and fourth volumes that have been published as well. And he survived, and so did the memoir, because he was married to an Aryan woman. So he fit through this very thin crack and just made it through. It's something of a harrowing tale as well. But just all of this detail about the day-to-day impact of losing his job, losing his driver's license, even losing his pets. Jews weren't allowed to keep pets. Somebody figured that one out as well at some point. And talking about how hard it was to give up their cat. They just loved their cat, you know, and they had to give up their cat as well. You know, putting on the star, what it felt like to have to put the star on. Not wanting to go outside with that star on. Dealing with curfews, dealing with cards, occasionally being threatened with being moved to a new area because someone was interpreting the law differently than someone else, and all of the stress that went with that on a daily basis. So during this period, of course, Klemperer goes further, including, you know, observing the firebombing of Dresden. He was there that night and barely got out of that. In terms of reading something, you really get much more than I can offer by reading Klemperer's work. So that gets us up to about 38, 39, just before the beginning of the war. So far, yes, these were onerous, irritating. Life was definitely inconvenient and more for persons deemed Jewish in Germany. But, you know, it was death by a thousand cuts up to this point. You could still get by. And the alternative was pretty dire to actually leave. Some did. Some left in 33, sure. People who had contacts abroad, scholars, intellectuals who could get Princeton to invite them or UCLA or something like that. Famous writers like Thomas Mann. But it's kind of an elite who have resources like that and opportunities. Of course, it's also that elite who would have been targeted earlier. So, you know, the wealthy businessmen and the public figures had to move quicker than the others did, I would say. So not to damn them for their qualities and for their reasons for leaving. You can't do that. But anyway, with the Anschluss of Austria, things became more intense. And they became more intense because from the German perspective, taking in Austria meant taking in more Jews, and suddenly the Jewish problem got bigger. Okay, that takes place in 38. Okay. 200,000, I have written here, more Jews are under their control. So in these bureaucratic circles that are trying to manage this and trying to figure out what to best do with it, they realize that they have more of a challenge on their hands. And in the midst of this, there's a crisis that's triggered by the assassination of a German diplomat by a Polish Jew. It's von Rath, R-A-T-H, who's assassinated in Paris. And in response to that, in November of 1938, they unleash the goons again. On the night of November 9, 1938, 20 years after the end of the First World War, or the beginning of the Weimar Republic, occurred what's known as the Night of Broken Glass. And it was in response to this specific thing, the assassination of this diplomat. So there's some sort of, not justification, but explanation for why Goebbels, I think it was Goebbels, approved this action, is the way they would put it. And what that involved was a very direct attack on all the major synagogues in Germany. They went in and ransacked them and tore the Torahs out and burned a number of them, including the synagogue in Berlin. And, of course, this was terrifying and unjust, and subsequent they forced the Jewish communities to pay for all damages that were incurred during these riots because somehow they were blamed for having triggered them. But it's on that night that the first large-scale arrests take place. So it's 5 years into the regime before you have 30,000 Jews rounded up and taken to the concentration camps, Dachau and Sachsenhausen. Okay. So, you know, again, it took some time for that to happen. But here's the first clear steps in that direction. It had not happened up to that time. Individual Jews may have been arrested, certainly harassed, sometimes beaten up, and so forth, but individual actions, and under the cover of law. But now you have these large-scale, I won't say massive yet, because I don't want to compare them to what becomes massive, which is coming. Now, in 1939, as Germany is moving toward war, Anschluss of Austria, taking the Sudetenland crisis, and Poland is on the horizon. Hitler made a speech, I believe in front of this Nazified Reichstag, where he would go in and make speeches every once in a while. And I'm not sure they called it that anymore. I'd have to look that up. And in it, he said the following, which is something that intentionalists look at. If international Jewish capitalism in and out of Europe should succeed once more in plunging the nations into war, so this is in the run-up to war, which of course he's instigating. I don't think anybody's going to argue that, but if they bring about a war, then the result will not be the Bolshevizing of this earth. Okay, it's not going to be the communist takeover of the earth. The Russian communists are not going to win this thing. But rather, the destruction of the Jewish race in Europe. Very public statement. Specifically saying, if war breaks out, the result is going to be the destruction of European Jewry. Destruction. Not just elimination. Now, why is that significant? Well, for those who are looking for clues as to intent, what they're looking for are clues that they plan to kill them. There's no doubt that they plan to do something to them. But elimination, and even eradication, you know, they're euphemisms. Nobody knows exactly what that means. We're going to get them out of the economy, right? Or are we just going to get them out of Germany? Right? And that's where this debate goes on. Right? Now, the reason for that is because at this time, in terms of planning, the stage they've arrived at is getting them into those concentration camps, but ghettoization, putting them into areas reserved for them. And when Germany invades Poland, I'm not going to say war breaks out between Germany and Poland, but when Germany invades Poland, right, the plan is to concentrate the Jews in particular areas. Okay. Now, what's going to happen there? But it's segregation. They're going to segregate. So now the step is segregation. Everything up to this point might be said to have been designed to get the Jews to emigrate, get them to leave, irritate them to the point where they leave. But of course, for the reasons I said and many others, you know, that wasn't always viable. Okay. Now it's going to be segregation, putting them in their own sectors, and indeed, this is applied primarily to the Polish Jews at first. They're not shipping German Jews out to Poland yet. But so the first step is to sort of isolate the Polish Jews in those areas in the war. Now, this process of eliminating is then defined as, by some, there are plans floating around for moving them from those ghettos, perhaps to territories further east. That would imply, you know, into the Soviet Union and beyond, but somewhere out there. Or even to an island off of the African coast, Madagascar. That was a very, you know, there's definitely documentation of this notion of moving them all to Madagascar, basically starving them on this island. So some argue, well, that's no different than extermination. You know, we're splitting hairs, and we are splitting hairs, I think. But I'm just giving you the basic. So, there are these ideas of segregation and elimination, in other words, eliminating them from Germany, eliminating them, getting them perhaps over to Poland, maybe further east, and maybe to Madagascar. This is, again, some indication that the plan wasn't clear that they were going to kill them. Now, it's of course the war that changes them. And what actually German coded language implied was, in fact, the truth. The war would provide cover for intensification of whatever it is they were going to do. It's in the midst of this war that they're going to be able to come up with some sort of solution to this problem, which is having too many Jews on their hands and what exactly the measures are going to be. And the code, I believe, I don't know exactly what circles use this, but it seems to be fairly common knowledge, for those procedures that unfold in Poland and further east during this period was Nachtunnebel. Night and fog. And this might be the juncture to say something about the fact that all of this, from this point on, is managed in a way designed to maintain some secrecy. They did not want this to come out. Now, we can search our minds for the reasons for that. I mean, they're already, you know, sticking a stick in the face of the West, and it looks like things are going to move to war, and I'm not, and the West is involved, and it's hard to imagine how they thought this would make things even worse. They may have been concerned about internal opposition. Again, people don't mind when this stereotypical Jew is being eliminated from other regions and other territories, but when your neighbor, who's only quarter Jewish anyway, or eighth Jewish, or whatever, suddenly is taken away at the night, people can get angry. And if they know that they're not just being moved to the other side of town, or moved to some sort of camp where other, you know, undesirable people are being moved, or maybe even moved to Poland, but that they're going to be able to work and survive and something, then you might stand up and defend them. You might, if you really knew what their fate was, if you're absolutely certain of that. But to the end, Himmler, we have record of this secret speech that he gave to SS officers, said, "This is a page of history that will never be written." It's a dirty job, basically, what he says, is what he says. And the heroism of those of us who are doing it, but this heroism of those who are doing it will never be told. It's only going to be those of us who are directly involved, who know what it's like, and he says, to look at a pile of 200, 400 bodies and to smell them burning or whatever. Himmler, by the way, visited a killing camp only once, and he got physically sick when he went. So, Unter Nacht und Nebel, under night and fog, this is all taking place. Well, what's taking place? The immediate brutalization of the environment triggered by the war was not at first directed toward the Jews. The Jews are being relocated and ghettoized there. The killing is directed first at soldiers, of course Polish soldiers, but then Polish political leaders and Polish intelligentsia. Okay, so they're the first victims of massive executions. I'm going to say no. Okay. The Jews in Germany are being harassed, and they're being, some of them are being put in certain sectors and ghettos and so on, but they're not being deported yet. Well, this is now 6 years into the regime. You wouldn't want to be putting that banner on, you know, after 33. So they've taken care of them sometimes. But in Poland, then it's political targets first, political and military targets first. So they're taken into collection centers, concentration camps, one of those is constructed at near this small town called Auschwitz. Okay, so it was first for war and political prisoners, Polish war and political prisoners. Okay. Just one aside. Back home, at about the same time that the war broke out, another policy was instituted, which was known as the T4 program.
I don't know what that stands for.
But it was called a euthanasia program. And this was part of the larger policy for the health of the race. And, of course, the elimination of Jews has to be understood within this broader framework. The last time I taught this course, there was a paper or a colloquium given at Loyola about medical doctors in the Third Reich. And some of us, I volunteered everybody to go, but some people showed up. And what we learned there was that through the Third Reich, there was tremendous public health programs. Tremendous. Anti-smoking, right? Exercise, lose weight, good nutritional programs, and so on. For Germans. The idea is that we're, you know, strengthening the race. And some of the research and so on, especially research about cigarette smoking and cancer, came out of that period in Germany. And some of the models for trying to minimize that were established there in the medical field. So there is this framework of cleansing and strengthening German health. And out of that comes an extreme measure, which is to eliminate weak specimens. And this is this whole racial theory. And did not just apply to Jews, and this is proof of that. It applied also to people of mental and physical disability, including alcoholism. And about, very quietly, about 100,000 adults and about 5,000 children were selected at four medical selection sites throughout Germany for elimination. And it's in fact in getting rid of some of those that the first experiments in using gas, carbon monoxide, were attempted. They first used injections, but looking for something more efficient, they pulled some trucks around to some buildings and put some of them into rooms and asphyxiated them with carbon monoxide. So that's the first record of gassing. And some of the lessons learned in there, like tell them it's a shower, came out of this T4 program, which is what they did with the physical and mentally handicapped. And just a little footnote or aside, it may that context may have been the only point where you do really have some effective resistance from some quarters of the German population, because they slipped up with the record keeping at one point, and a number of people got the same announcement, which, you know, your son and daughter had to have an emergency operation and unfortunately didn't survive. That's what they sent. But they sent it to 25 people or 100 people or 500 people who got it all at the same time, and they just put everything together and they realized what was going on. And the mothers demonstrated against it. And I think that's the only real record of popular opposition that had some success, and the mothers weren't just immediately silenced and arrested and so forth. And they did halt that policy for a little while. It continued later, but its significance in the history of the Holocaust is that that's where some of the techniques that are applied to the gas chambers were first developed. Now, what's going on in Poland is just intensified with the invasion of the Soviet Union, of Russia. So it's really the summer of 1941 that things press toward their terrible conclusion. First of all, attacking the Soviet Union so successfully put a huge numbers of Russian soldiers in their hands. And so the Auschwitz then, for instance, becomes a center for processing Russian soldiers. And the treatment of these Russian soldiers is, well, you know. But again, it's pressing, it's increasing brutalization and learning how to handle massive numbers of people. And from that, those processes, they, you know, that's what evolves. But a number of Soviet prisoners are brought to Auschwitz, and in fact, at Auschwitz, the first application of gassing and then the use of Zyklon B and so on are applied to Russian soldiers. So again, it's this very gradual process. Now, with the invasion of Russia, the invasion of Russia was perceived as a political as well as a racial war. So when they go into Russia, they do so with the intention, at least the SS by now, of rounding up and killing the Jews that they find there. And this could be partly, I'm just extrapolating here, but because they feel like they've got enough of a problem back here, they don't need more. So you have the development and implementation of these special mission groups, Sondereinsatzgruppen, as part of the SS. They go in with the regular troops, but targeting partisans, in other words, non-official Russian resistors, Russian soldiers, but also Jews. And their job is just to round these people up and kill them. Now, in the long run, those Sondereinsatzgruppen have given members of the German army the opportunity to say, we were just soldiers. It's those Sondereinsatzgruppen and the SS that were doing that stuff. We were just fighting the war. We were hell on Russian soldiers. We occasionally were tough on partisans, but we weren't the ones that were doing it. Subsequent study of the records and so on shows that actually Wehrmacht were involved with these things. There's an overlap there. The Sondereinsatzgruppen were working in areas where regular soldiers were around. Regular soldiers were turning captives over to them. Regular soldiers were often brought into these actions as well. So it's a lot fuzzier, and you can't say anymore that, oh, I was just in the regular army, I didn't have anything to do with that. You have to justify that. And there were also SS soldiers and officers who said, well, we were with the Waffen-SS, the armed SS, not with those Sondereinsatzgruppen. But we know now that the lines were much fuzzier than that. Just another thing that if you study this and you get to know it, some of the issues and the debates that have come up. But the Sonder Einsatzgruppen were in charge of this policy and this process.
You bring up the Waffen SS. Mm-hmm. I've heard few different people state in essays that the war on the Eastern Front, to a large extent, was a civil war involving peoples who were breaking away from communist rule and people who were sympathetic to the Nazi cause. How does that, if it holds merit, fit into this Eastern Front paradigm?
Well, I can just say this. In many regions east of Poland, Germans were initially could be welcomed as liberators. And it didn't take long for those individuals to realize that that wasn't the case. But they might have been able to present themselves as liberators, and if they had gone in and not instituted these atrocities, if it weren't a race war from their perspective, if they didn't see every individual who had lived under Soviet control as the enemy, they might have been able to occupy Russia and manage it with the support of individuals who saw that as a way of getting out from under Stalinist control. I don't think that's specifically what you asked, but I think that's the broader issue that comes out of it, that Nazi policy triggered, you know, partisan resistance. It didn't have to go that way. And Stalin would not have survived the war if the Nazis had managed it differently. They could probably have won in the East if they hadn't imposed this race policy and the viciousness with which they attacked the Soviet system in this ideological perspective rather than in a practical way.
Well, what about groups like the Cossacks who, in essence, split with their alliances, and then like the Sonderkommandos, you have the NKVD on the Russian side committing many of the same atrocities once the Russians reached Eastern.
My response blanket, there were definitely covers that. I mean, there were definitely opportunities. You could go into the specifics of it, but it's Nazi, the brutal methods that were actually formulated in orders given to the generals as they entered that they were going to basically take no prisoners from the start. So that policy and the intensity with which they applied it once the war, once the invasion took place, in the long run had negative effects on their ability to manage the area and motivated those. I mean, if it was going to be Stalin or the Germans, you had no choice. But getting a little bit off the track, which is already quite a long one, studies have shown that Eastern Front soldiers really felt that there was nowhere to turn. They had nowhere to turn on either side. If you were fighting in front of Stalingrad, and this is why it's so vicious, all you could do was fight as hard as you possibly could, because if you were taken prisoner, you were going to be treated viciously, and if they thought you were fighting anything less than with everything that you had, you were going to be punished and perhaps executed or tortured by your own political operatives. So an individual soldier had really no option but to fight viciously for their own survival. It was just pure survival. And the psychological impact that it had on those fighting in the Eastern Front is extreme. And explains just why it was so brutal, because it was perceived in ideological terms. You were not, from the government's position on both sides, or the high command's position on both sides, you were not fighting against human beings. The dehumanization process reached its extremes in the camps, as we'll be talking about, and at the front. the opposition in both cases was perceived as bestial, and you know, the result was killing in unprecedented rates. So these special groups are rounding up villages, and I can't tell you exactly how these are being selected right now, and marching them off to isolated areas in the woods or hills nearby. And at first, the process is to shoot them. And this is where you can see the images of big trenches having been dug, and maybe films of people stripped down out in this woods somewhere, or out on some sort of sandy rolling hills, and then run out along these trenches, and then firing squads sitting there and firing. Yeah.
Why did they take so much documentary footage?
Well, there you get the ironies of, was this secret or was it not? And the other thing you have to keep in mind is that there are many, many, many people involved and around all of these things. So where this footage comes from, was it done officially, was it officially sanctioned? A lot of the photographs are not. And what you have are photographs being sent back to Germany of soldiers saying, look what I'm doing out on the Eastern Front. And that's where you get into that dehumanization process, questions, and how can these guys be doing this? And you know, shots of themselves drinking vodka or beer and having a party, and in the back you can see what's going on in the shots, or you know, literally pictures of them lighting a old Jewish man's beard on fire or something like that, all sitting around laughing and drinking vodka. Those kind of photographs are being sent back. They're actually stopped, but that's censored. But there may have been some official effort to document, but of course they assume they're going to win the war and those documents aren't going to be made public, right? So those aren't showing up in newsreel films. Those aren't showing up in, you know, Triumph of the Will that's being sent to the Paris International Film Festival or something like that, you know. And frankly, I suppose if we lined it all up, there probably isn't that much, but you see it all the time because it's all been clipped into the documentaries, and I don't know if there's more. Yeah. Well, having watched too many of these, I can say I've probably seen a lot of the same things over and over again. So it adds up, but there may not be actually that much footage if you consider the enormity of the whole thing. Now, this Nickschuss, they call it shooting in the back of the neck, even though it was a messy job. And the units who did it didn't like. And they complained about it. And their officers complained that this was having psychological effects on those poor guys. So from the beginning, that's not perceived as ideal. And in fact, it's because of the complaints of how messy and inefficient that process was that there's this ongoing effort in various circles to figure out better ways to do it. The documentary highlights, and I don't know how important it was, but indicative of this was some officer who had some high access or was in control of some high explosives is told to go out, maybe it was to Auschwitz or somewhere near there, and try, and he didn't know what he was supposed to do with this high explosives that he'd bring. I'll just call it like dynamite, something like that. And he didn't know what he was supposed to do with it. It was sort of hush-hush. He drove out there with this car full of dynamite or this truck full of dynamite. And they said, oh, good, you know, did you bring enough? He said, well, I brought twice as much as I was told to bring. Very, very good. So, and what they did was they went out with and put these groups of probably Soviet or Polish prisoners around high explosives and tried to blow them up. Well, that was messy because the body parts got stuck in the trees. You know, that's what the documents say. So that doesn't work too well. And then there's some who begin to use carbon monoxide. And the idea from that, you know, at least according to the film, is that somebody fell asleep at the wheel and almost died, and bing, we can try that. I don't know if that's true, but some of the documents much indicate that. And the first application of that, outside of that T4 program, was applied to Soviet prisoners. So again, that's not immediately applied to Jews. But once that is tested, they come up with a scheme which is referred to as the Black Ravens. And that was trucks, vans, which had just had their exhaust pipes redirected up into their container. And these Black Ravens started to be used in the invaded territories, and so whole towns would be, you know, the Jews would be put into the synagogue, for instance, and then groups of them would be taken out in this van and driven around for 20 minutes or half an hour and gassed in the back of that. But still, you don't have these gassing installations yet. That was the perhaps they would set up a truck and its exhaust would just be directed into some basement room somewhere. So small-scale use of carbon monoxide. It's in August of 1941 that Zyklon B is first used, again on Soviet prisoners. Did I skip something here? T4. Now, what Zyklon B was, just so you know, I mean, this is sort of just, I'm going to tell you this stuff, and there it is, okay? Not relishing it, but these are the kind of questions that come up. And then we'll turn to the mental impact of it all. Zyklon B was a disinfectant that was used for cleaning uniforms. And it was used for cleaning uniforms in these camps as well. Nothing was wasted in these camps, so you know the uniforms were reused, and they would clean them up and disinfect them. And it was also, I think, a pesticide if used in gas form. And if you needed to disinfect a room, and this was used in industries, for instance, or cleaning up a McDonald's or whatever, if you expose these pellets of this chemical to the air, then it would, I don't know what the term is, combust, turn into gas, gasify. I think that's a word, isn't it? And someone came up with the idea of using that on Soviet prisoners. And that took place in August 1941. But none of this has coalesced into a clear... all these things are going on at the same time. There's the shooting going on, there's the Black Ravens, and somebody's trying these on the Soviet soldiers, and so on and so forth. It's not until January of 1942 that all of this lines up. And in January of 1942 occurs a meeting at which the officer, the SS officer who was in charge of trying to figure out what could be done with this very messy process. His name was Reinhard Heydrich, Heydrich. He gets together a conference of those who are immediately involved. And that's not Hitler, Himmler, Goebbels, Goering, and so forth. It's Heydrich, Höss, Adolf Eichmann. They're these middle-level, bureaucratic types. And if they didn't have the SS uniforms on, it would just look like a boardroom. And that's who these guys were. They were all, a lot of them, overrepresented, we've used that term before, lawyers. They were lawyers. A lot of them had legal training. anyway, they get together and work out what is referred to as the final solution. Well, now you know why that term means what it does. All these other things are interim solutions. They're looking for a final solution, an Endlösung. So it's the end to all of this hodgepodging around. And what that means is bureaucratic organization, primarily. And centralization, I would guess, of some of these procedures, throwing some money at the problem, and getting it to work more efficiently. And this is when the paper trail becomes very important, right? Because now, you know, they are going to, and I'm just sort of estimating this, but we're going to contract with the railroads, we're going to contract with industries in Germany, get good bids for better equipment, right? And we're going to centralize these things at certain sites and start applying things. That's what takes place at the Wannsee Conference. W-A-N-N-S-E-E, the Wannsee Conference. And they're going, they say, well, we're going to use this Cyclone B. So it does get down to those kinds of specifics. It's not until February of 1942, so a month after Wannsee, that Zyklon B is used in Auschwitz to kill Jews. So, but you can see that direct, the decisions made in January and in February now. And it's applied there. Now, then you get into I'll give you these details, the history of what goes on at Auschwitz. Because even that's not a final solution. At first, they do it in a crematorium in the main camp. But the problem is, everybody can hear them screaming. Details. Right? But this is where theory is applied. It took about 30 minutes for people to die from this. It's not, which, if you imagine the whole process, is, you know, horrifying. They were packed into these rooms. The estimate, because they wanted to do it efficiently and they have it all measured, was 1 foot per person. So these people were just crammed into these rooms. That's what he was talking about, everybody standing up. And women holding their children. That's what he was talking about. Because they're just in there like this. And they're screaming and they're desperate once the last people are being pushed in. And then the gas would come on. But then it took 30 minutes for that to have its effect on a full group of people. And the screaming would go on for 30 minutes. So what they tried at first was to put motorcycles out in front of the room that this was being done in, and rev up the engine so that people couldn't hear the screaming. See, it's a nuts and bolts process. So in the spring of 42, after February, this is what we just saw. The transport of the Slovakian Jews to Auschwitz, and the use of the separate gas chamber outside of camp in these little red and white houses for the process. So that was the next step. In the fall of 1942, the deportations of French Jews started, especially children. And they went directly to Auschwitz. In December of 42, so winter, Himmler orders most gypsies in Germany to be deported to Auschwitz. So the gypsies are moved there. It's in the spring of 43, so a year after they started really killing at Auschwitz, that those new gas chambers that are, you just saw the image of at the end, in which they were able to kill 10,000 a day, were constructed. And they had that external entrance. They would go down and fill that big hall. And they had those cages that they showed, those cages that reached up to the ceiling. That's what they would pour the Zyklon B into from above. And then after the 30 minutes, crews would go in and push the bodies, and they had elevators at the other end, and the elevators would go right up into the crematoria. And then they would go into the ovens there. So it was very efficient. The problem of carrying those bodies over to the pits, digging the pits, throw them in, was eliminated. That's when they started to burn them. In the fall of 43, the first Jews from Rome were deported to Auschwitz. Hence, Prevost Levi and going there. In May of 1944, 440,000 Jews from Hungary were sent to Auschwitz and liquidated. In August of 1944, the Jews of the Lodz ghetto, which is the largest ghetto outside of Warsaw in Poland, were sent directly to Auschwitz. And in that month, so August, September of 1944, Allied bombers did strike the Auschwitz area. Now, this is a big issue. Levy talks about it. I don't know the date off the top of my head. But somewhere here, after 42 or so, information has reached the Allies that this is going on and where it's going on, including photographs. So there's a debate as to whether or not Churchill and Roosevelt and so on should have taken action. When they did bomb, they didn't bomb the camp section that was part of the extermination policy. They bombed the camp section that was an industrial plant producing rubber, supposedly, trying to produce rubber, where Levy lived. And that's important for us to understand. This book does not tell us about the extermination section of Auschwitz. It tells us about the labor section of Auschwitz. He's in Buna, the UNA, as he calls it, which is the IG Farben chemical plant intended to create rubber, and Birkenau. Birkenau is the section that was built with the gas chamber. And when Allied bombers did strike, they made a decision. Somebody made the decision not to strike the extermination camp, but to strike only the factory. Well, the reason for that is they were only going to use Allied resources to hit things that were important to the war effort. Okay? And there were arguments about, well, what are you going to do? Bomb the camps? Now, probably, maybe those who were in the camps would have liked to have seen the camps bombed and to sacrifice themselves in the hope that this wouldn't go on anymore. But there was some reservation about actually bombing the inhabitants of the camps. You bomb a factory and you have moral justification to it because those people are, even if it's against their will, contributing to the war effort. So the Allied reasoning was, we do everything we can to end the war as quickly as possible, but we're not going to deflect things in order to just halt something, and we're not even sure we can halt it, and in doing so we might victimize the victims anyway. So it's fuzzy. And I'm not here to close the argument. You have to decide for yourself. But in all cases, the record of German capability for restoring damaged factories, as had been the case throughout the war, and the reason the Allied bombers had to go over and hit those ball bearing factories and then hit them again and hit them again and hit them again, is they were good at getting things back underway. And if you knocked out a railhead, they had the railway running again within, you know, a few days, if not 24 hours. So if you were to, there's the argument, well, they should have hit the trains, they should have hit the, you know, to break it up and so on and so forth. And I don't disagree with that argument, morally. I'm just saying, well, planners had to make their decisions, and that's just the way it happened.
You had talked about how the Allies got somehow information about the concentration camps, and I think it came out in life, and it just appalled American people.
I think
that was in contemporary.
It was it? Okay. Yeah. I think earlier than that, there was some Swedish diplomat who had some information about this and that.
But like coming out on a mass scale.
Right, on a mass scale, right. And I'm not even sure how, it was pretty late in the game. It was certainly 44. I mean, we were already in the European theater by then, right? But yeah, I think that's true. November of 44, the last reported transport of Jewish prisoners arrives at Auschwitz for gassing. But on November 25, the SS began the destruction of the crematoria. They started to cover their tracks. Never completely did. In January of 1945, they started their effort to remove prisoners from Auschwitz, these death marches. As Allied troops approach, tens of thousands of prisoners from several concentration camps are forced to march on foot to other camps in Germany. Those are horrible stories. Thousands who are too weak to march or who commit any infraction during the march are shot. January 27, 1945, Soviet troops liberate Auschwitz. Only a few thousand prisoners remain, and most of them would have been at Buna, where Primo Levi was. So, those are the facts, more or less. I think it's important just to lay them out. You may have heard them elsewhere, but if you haven't, this is basically what we know, drawn from these videos and or that documentary, other historical sources. There's no denying. The paper trail is there. All these things are verified with documents, photographs, and orders that have been passed down. So that's simply not an argument. It's not worthwhile. But it is important to read the record and acknowledge that, because a lot of these facts have been, you know, it's been necessary for those who survived it to verify it in the face of deniers, in the face of the general effort on the part of the perpetrators to keep it under night and fog. But I don't think there's any question of the facts. Some of the order here, some of the very specific dates and so on, I have generalized, but in every case here, I think it's founded on the documentary evidence. So, are there any other questions I could try to answer, if you want to throw those out before we take a break and then look at Levi and for his record of the intellectual and emotional and psychological impact of it all. Yeah?
When you talked about the C4 plan, and you mentioned that 50% of people were part of the party group, would that have included World War I?
No, I think not. Because their interest, it's a eugenic program, right? So it's genealogical defects that they're attempting to eradicate, part of that purification of the next generation of Aryans. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well, that's a key question, right? And to a certain degree, I think the whole issue of intentionalism versus functionalism is related to that issue. Because if you knew in 1920 this is what they were going to do, right, there might have been more qualms about it. Right? the fact that they had to keep it undercover to a certain degree, at least keep it a very sort of public secret, but maintain the semblance of secrecy, is an indication that they were concerned that people wouldn't have accepted that. It's possible. All of their policy of terror was done in a very psychologically efficient way. You didn't know if you were going to get in trouble for something exactly. You might be able on one day tell a bad joke about Fuhrer and get away with it for a few days, and then the joke might be passed on, and your nephew might get arrested for it. It just depends on who was around and so on. They were very and that also shows that it wasn't just this absolute monolithic system. It sort of depended on who you ran into. Was there an informer around, right? So there's a lot of gray. There was a lot of gray in this whole environment about exactly what the Führer wanted, about exactly what the policy was, about exactly, for instance, what a Jew was. There was reason to be confused, at least. And so rumors about what was happening to those who were being moved east, at least initially, could also be shrugged off, arguably. And it'd be hard to prove. No, you must have known. You should have known. It's incontrovertible that you would have known that this is going on. If you had a family member who was on the Eastern Front and had sent back pictures, or their friend had sent back pictures and they knew what was going on, then, well, okay, you would know what was going on. Listening to rumors and wondering if that's going on is different from knowing. So, we have to be fair in that sense. When Primo Levi is at Buna, okay, he doesn't know what's going on at Birkenau. He doesn't know that those selections are leading right to gas chambers. He doesn't know that. He's right there. Some people are saying, selection. You don't believe in selection, you Italianer? Right? That's what they're saying to him. You don't believe it? Some know. But, he someone like him could be right there and not be certain what was going on. So, it's fuzzy. But what the documents indicate is that the circle of people who had to know was pretty large. Was pretty large. But it's this bureaucratic paper trail, working out, let's say, from the Wannsee conference, at least, where company bids are coming in, designs are being made, deals with the railroad are being cut. Okay, that's a pretty wide circle, but that's the way you have to go to be able to say they knew. The movie Shoah, which is a French film about the whole process, especially from France, focuses particularly on the railroads. The train system was, even in my mind, or maybe especially in my mind, when I go to Germany and ride the train, you just can't help but think about it. Now they're getting really modern trains, so they don't quite look the same, but back in the 80s when I would go there, it still felt kind of icky, I'll put it that way. It's just so symbolic of them being placed on those trains. And Eastern German trains looked pretty much like the same as the trains that they were using in the 40s, so your senses were overloaded. Well, it was a very bureaucratic process of transporting these people from Rome, from Hungary, from German cities when they do start to transport them. They first had to negotiate a deal. The government, the SS, or whoever was in charge of it, had to pay the Deutsche Bahn, the German railroad. They had to be paid for this. Their books had to be balanced. Right? And at first they gave them a tourist rate. They gave them a tourist rate. And then it was bumped down because they didn't want to use it, or they weren't using tourist cars, I think that maybe was the argument. So they ultimately got either a cattle or an industrial transport rate. And you can see these negotiations, you can see these documents, the money's changing hands to pay for the transport of these individuals. And then as the film shows, Showa conductors or train employees had to know that there were full trains going out to certain points and empty trains coming back. And so they go and interview these railroad guys and go, "Didn't you put one and one together?" Right? So they call them on that. You had to know that that was going on. But it takes that kind of spade work to be able to take a German from the period, you know, grab him by the collar and say, "You had to know. You can't deny it." Because it was rather fuzzy. So the answer is, right? But that's the answer. I mean, it is that complicated in all of these cases.